Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Kate Loving and the Collective Wisdom. My name is Kate Loving Schenck of katelovingschenck.com, prayerprescriptions.com, and the author of the upcoming book, Prayer Prescriptions, Spiritual Remedies for Long-Lasting Health. My guest today is Tom Stirner, author of The Practicing Mind, Developing Focus and Discipline in Your Life. And believe me, it's a lot more fun than it sounds. The call-in number is 347-205-9200. Joining me now is Tom Stirner. Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. How are you?
Thanks for having me on your show. It's great to be here.
Thank you so much. I am very, I love this book, and I just think that there's so much to be learned from it, and I would like you to teach us a few things in this hour that we have together.
Okay.
So, first of all, what inspired you to write the book in the first place?
The book actually was, I think it started out almost as a journal when I was, that I started probably in my mid to late 20s. When I was very young, I was not a very disciplined person, and I think what saved me from that was the fact that I was aware that I was not a very disciplined person. I'm not really sure how I would explain that, but I think the way that it manifested in my life was that I was constantly inspired to try new things, but then I would lose my inspiration fairly shortly into the endeavor and then drop it and move to the next thing. And I, when I say that I was aware of this lack of discipline, I was aware that I had this pattern of behavior where I would get interested in something and then I would drop it. And it really upset me because I felt like I couldn't complete any task that I myself had chosen, which meant that I'm not sure that being a young person that I really thought it out that clearly, except that the way it felt inside was that I didn't have any power. I felt like I could not accomplish my dreams unless I changed that. And somewhere between then and in my mid-20s, I found that people were constantly referring to me as the most disciplined person they knew. And so I really began to ask myself, well, this is not how I pictured myself, but if I look at what I've accomplished, I guess I would have to agree with that. So how did I get here? And then I began to really kind of become retrospective and look at what had changed, what I had read, what I had thought, and how I had gotten to that point. And that's really where the book began.
So you were wondering, if you did not think of yourself as being disciplined, and everybody else did you wonder how disciplined they were, I guess? I guess because here we are talking about the judging mind, which is what you do talk about too. But anyway, it was a good catalyst or inspiration for you to start thinking about this whole process, actually.
And, it was.
Yeah. I mean, you talk about product versus process and how if we stay in the process, which would be the act of doing whatever it is that we're doing and not concentrating on the horizon or the goal, then we'll be much happier people.
That's true. And I think that the problem with our culture today is that the opposite is what we're taught, and it's what's reinforced on a daily basis. We're a very bottom-line society, And we are made, I think that what happens is that almost all of us, I think it's fair to say, have a certain sense of feeling incomplete inside. We don't necessarily define it as that, but it's what motivates us to move in all these different directions. And that feeling of incompleteness is used by the marketing media to make us feel like, well, this item or this thing here or will make you feel complete. So what we're always doing is attaching ourselves to something outside of ourselves with this sense that I know I'm not happy, I know I feel incomplete. If I can just get to there, then everything will be better. And because of that, we look at the process of getting, which is the time period of where we start and where we end up, as being this nuisance that we have to endure so we can just get to this point out here where all of a sudden we'll feel happiness. And that is a complete fallacy. And it's not only that we're talking about it here, but it's being talked about and studied in peak performance in many, many different areas. It's also part of most all of the ancient thought systems in the East, and it's been proven out that it's not a very productive way of going through your life, and it just breeds unhappiness.
Well, when you talked about the, you know, sailors or anybody going towards the horizon, well, the horizon doesn't exist. And that struck me. I mean, I realized that it's a concept that we've all heard before, but somehow it really struck me as being very poignant because the horizon does not really exist. Now, it's not to say that, I don't mean to say that we don't have any goals and we aren't striving for something, but the point being, and that's your point, that it's not the goal that makes us happy. It's the process leading up to the goal.
Yes. I mean, if we look at human beings, the human spirit loves a challenge. And when it doesn't have a challenge, it looks for a challenge. One of the groups of people that I find myself working with on a fairly routine basis are young athletes. And many times it's in the golfing world. And at one of the clinics, I was standing in front of a room full of young people. I'm talking about maybe 14 to 18, 17, 18 years old. And I asked them, I said, what do you do when you play a video game and you master it? What do you do? And unanimously, they all said, you get rid of it. I said, why is that? And they said, because it's boring. I said, so you go get another one that you can't do. And they said, that's right. I said, well, why do you think that is? And they said, I don't know. I said, because you like the challenge. As soon as something becomes effortless to you, you're not interested in it anymore. That's because that's how we're built. That's the reason why we've evolved, and it's the reason why we accomplish goals, and we pick goals in the first place. That's what drives us, and we need to stop fighting with that and thinking that it's our enemy and realize that that is our nature. And so that means that we're always going to be operating in this mode where we're going to be picking these goals that we want to get to, and it's the actual process of achieving the goal is what we're hungering for, and that's what we enjoy is that. And then as soon as we master it, then we need something else to fulfill that need inside to be achieving something. So it's the achieving is where the juice is. It's not the actual getting to the point where the game is easy to do.
Right. And as you point out, too, when you're learning a new skill that does require practice, you don't look at the whole thing and think, oh, my God, I can't do it. You just break it down into smaller parts. And I love your whole – oh, I don't want to jump ahead to the solutions to this, but one of the first things you have to do is create a sense of patience. And patience is something that most people don't think that they have. But we can cultivate it, right?
We can cultivate it. And one of the switches for that is to realize that, you know, patience – whenever we're being patient, we don't really notice it, because when we're patient, it's a very comfortable place to be. What we do notice is when we're impatient, and impatient, because it's an uncomfortable place to be. And impatience is a very quick tip off that you're no longer in the present moment. You're not in the process. Because when you're impatient, it means that you're feeling you want to be someplace else. You need to be someplace else. And you're no longer doing what you're doing right now. So I think that one of the, and so if you follow that a little bit farther forward, then you go, well, why am I feeling that way? And we're back to the thing of, because we're feeling like we're incomplete and we need to get to here, and then we'll feel good. And that's really where that impatience comes from. So once again, it's when we begin to switch and let go of these false paradigms, if you want to call them that, but these ideas that create this sense inside of us that self-perpetuates it, itself, then we begin to experience we actually begin to live the moment, and we begin to experience the moment, and we begin to feel like where I'm at is where I need to be, and I've been missing the joy that's in this moment of what I'm doing. It sounds you know, kind of new agey, but it's really been proven out in sports psychology and so many different areas that this is when we're operating at our maximum, and when we're also enjoying the actual experience the most.
When we're patient, right? When we are patient.
Patience to me is a natural result of wanting to be in the moment. If you want to be in the moment, then you're here. There's nothing to be impatient about, because where you want to be is where you are. Impatience to me comes from an attachment to some place other than where you are and doing something other than what you're doing right now. That's where impatience comes from. And again, we're fed all day long through the media, the television, everything. Our economy runs on this making you feel like you're not where you're supposed to be. You need to be here. You need to be getting this. And so that's constantly reinforced, and it starts when we're very young children. And so it's a system of thinking that we really have to become aware of and then unlearn it to free ourselves from it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you say that impatience is uncomfortable, and actually it causes a lot of disharmony in the atmosphere with people. When people are all gathered together and there's a certain amount of people that are just completely impatient and just irritable, because it does cause irritability. The person is irritable who is impatient. And really, it's just not a very team player kind of attitude to have. You know, the more patient you are, the more it breeds patience. And people want to be with you if you are patient.
They do, because it's much more comfortable to be around you, and the energy that comes off you is much more comfortable. I mean, nobody wants to be around. If you look at someone who is to expand on that, if you look at someone who's always in a bad mood, well, nobody wants to be around that person, because it's uncomfortable and their energy is just exuding, you know, from them, and you feel like they make you uneasy. They make you feel agitated, and you really can't wait to get away from them. But by the same token, people that are very kind, very patient, very laid back are real easy to be around, and they have almost a calming nature about them.
Yes. Yes. Well, I noticed this in my profession as a nurse, that you have to be patient, but so many times people aren't, and that can cause so much problems around the sick bed, the death bed, the birth bed, you know, whatever. And the person who is sick, who is birthing, who is dying, or whatever, really wants you to be calm. They want you to be patient. They want you to be with them in the moment, not necessarily saying anything or you know, trying to make conversation, but to be there with them. And that's a great lesson, really.
Well, yeah, and I would say that is I think that what you're talking about is being present. And I think that that is something that, you know, is very unusual in our culture today. I mean, we try to do too many things in a day. We're distracted all the time. And, in fact, we don't like being – we don't like quietness, and we're uncomfortable with stillness. In fact, you know, there was one day I was in a convenience store having a sandwich made, you know, and I was waiting with 20 other people for my sandwich to come up. And I happened to just look around this place to make an observation. And here's all these people standing there. Nobody's talking to each other. And the people behind the counter are making all the sandwiches. But they have the two televisions up that are blasting the news, music coming out of these sound systems. And I thought to myself, you know, we're so uncomfortable with any kind of quiet. We always have to have something to occupy our minds, and we have to be able to watch this news thing that most of us don't really care about anyway, what's on there. We've got music, which is conflicting with what's coming out of the television. But if at the same time, if you were to turn the television off and turn the music off, and all of a sudden this store became dead quiet and everybody was sitting there, people would become very uneasy, you know, with the silence, because they would feel like they didn't know what to do with it. And I think that that's really – it's really sad that we have gotten to that point. People are uncomfortable about maybe looking at the person next to them and starting a conversation, or even just being still. They feel like there should be something going on all the time.
Yes, yes. And that kind of situation is apparent with people with their cell phones always having to be texting, always having to be checking it. and that is something that if people became aware of it, they would realize that it's really not making them feel relaxed or happy. They're just not with it. They're not with it. What's happening?
Well, then you bring up two good points. One is that the studies are showing, and there's research out on this that is showing that what is happening with our brains is that we are asking our brains to operate at a faster speed. We are asking our brains to not be present moment, but to skim and scan. We go, like you said, we're texting, we're on the internet, and we skim through and we look for the links. I mean, most people, if you talk to them, they don't read a page of text on the screen when they go to websites. They just kind of skim it real quickly to see if there's something there that they're looking for. And what they're finding is that our brains are getting better and better at doing this, but at the same time, our brains are atrophying in their ability, the area of the brain that is still and is contemplative and is able to focus for long periods of time, like to read a novel, is atrophying, and it's not, it's becoming more and more difficult for us to do this. And that's the reason why, you know, we have trouble sitting still. You know, if you just say, well, just go sit in the chair in the living room for half an hour, people can't do it. I mean, they just become so antsy, they feel like they need to check their email. I mean, all sorts of stuff like that. And I think that's really important. But the second point I think that you alluded to a few minutes ago is that none of this can be that we're talking about here can be changed or affected, or if we don't have some awareness of what we're the fact that we're participating in this. And that awareness, to me, when I talk to people and I work with people, the first thing I ask them to do is not right in front of me, but at some point later in the day, to sit down in a chair and stop thinking for 10 minutes. Just put an egg timer on or whatever you want and stop thinking for 10 minutes. And what they always find is that they can't. And it may be the first time in their life that they realize that they can't turn their mind off. There's no off switch, that the mind just keeps making thoughts whether it has their permission or not. And for most people, they're never aware of this, and so they're not aware of the thoughts that their mind is producing without their permission. And those thoughts can be anxiety, reactions to people saying something unkind, traffic jams, whatever it is, and they just basically go along for the ride. So it's very important to begin to develop within ourselves an ability to separate ourselves from our thoughts and to realize that we're not our thoughts. We're the one that has the thoughts. We experience the thoughts. And we don't really become a conscious choice maker in our lives until we can separate from that and begin to learn to control what thoughts we have and what thoughts we don't, and also to be able to separate ourselves to so that we are aware that, well, we're having this thought, it's making us angry. We're having this, it's the thought that's doing that to us. It's not, we're not making, we don't have a chance to make a choice as whether we get angry if we're just in the thought. So that's a very, very important part, and I don't know any other way to do that without experiencing some sort of meditation. And you can,
exactly.
I don't care what you call it. You can label it whatever you want. It does, you know, if you don't like the word meditation, then call it thought training or something else. But learn to sit still for some time during the day, 10 minutes in the morning, 10 minutes in the evening, and learn to pay attention to whether your mind is thinking, whether it's not, what it's thinking. And just in that moment when you do that, you begin to learn that you're not your thoughts, and you begin to separate from that, and you begin to empower yourself. I call it giving yourself, you know, the key to the prison door. And the mm-hmm. other thing that's important, and I know I'm going on here a little bit, but I just want to finish this thought, and that is that what people need to realize when you begin to try to meditate, it's not what the goal. We don't want to do the same thing that we were talking about earlier, where you set up this goal and you feel like, well, until I get to that goal, I'm not going to be happy. So you don't want to sit down and say, well, until I can stop my thoughts, I'm not going to be happy. That's not the point of meditation.
Right. Mm-hmm.
The point is to notice when your mind is like, you sit down and you say, you know what, I'm just going to watch myself breathe for 10 minutes. And what will happen is you start to do that, and then you'll wake up from that and realize that you're at the hardware store in your head, or you're having a conversation with somebody at work in your head, and you'll realize, oh, I'm not paying attention to my breath. Instead, I'm having this conversation in my head. It's in that little blink of a time period there where you become aware that mm-hmm. you're not, your mind has taken off on a path, and you just keep becoming aware, and it goes off, and you become aware and bring it back, and it goes off, and you become aware, and you bring it back. It's in that process that you're truly expanding and you're strengthening yourself. And in that, just the repetition and the, quote, practice of that repetition over and over again with the intention of slowing your mind down and paying attention to just your breathing or just the mantra phrase that you're saying, if that's what you're using, that's mm-hmm. where the self-expansion comes, and that's where the strength comes from. And that will become a part of you all day long. What will begin to happen is somebody will say something to you that is offensive, or and you'll go, isn't that interesting? I'm starting to have this annoyed thought. You won't be the annoyed thought. You'll be aware that you're having the annoyed thought.
Yes.
And you begin to have the choice of, well, I'm not going to go there because that's going to upset me and make me feel lousy, and it's not going to solve anything. And all of a sudden, you begin to be the one in control.
Mm-hmm. Yes, because the meditation practice helps us to become aware of just being in the present moment. And then you make a statement in your book, quote, you cannot change what you are unaware of. You know, that is so true.
It is. And awareness has to come first. And this is how we develop awareness, awareness of, you know, we were talking earlier about being patient and impatient. Well, most people just are in the experience of being impatient. They are mm-hmm. not thinking, you know, I'm feeling impatient right now. That's a big difference, you know,
yeah.
between just being impatient and annoyed and realizing, you know, I'm having thoughts of being impatient here. Because when you're just feeling impatient, you're not in control of the experience. When you say, you know, I'm having thoughts of being impatient, now you're in control. And it's a very subtle thing, but it is mm-hmm. huge in terms of what it gives you in your life as far as self-control and the ability to make choices.
Yeah, totally true. And another thing to do is to stop looking for progress, is something you say. That when we look for progress, we're not in the present moment, to simplify it that way.
When we, yeah, and progress to me is, you know, is interesting because there's the analogy in there, the flower. You know, if you look at a flower and you say, at what point in a flower's life is the flower perfect? Well, the truth is that the flower is always perfect at being a flower at whatever point it is in its life cycle. The
mm-hmm.
flower doesn't sit there and say, I'm not making progress fast enough to bloom. you know, the flower is just where it's at is when it's a seed, it's a perfect seed. It's a perfect flower being a seed. When it's germinating, it's a perfect flower germinating. When it blooms, it's a perfect flower blooming. And everything in between. It doesn't sit there and judge where it is in relationship to something else. And I think that this is one of the problems that we have, which again goes back to this sense of feeling incomplete and feeling like I'm not making progress fast enough. And, you know, that's you know, I've always felt it was interesting how we create goals. And then what we do is arbitrarily assign a time frame to the goal. For example, we say, I think I need to lose 10 pounds. And then there's this arbitrary thing in our mind that says, well, let me see. If I work at it, it should take me maybe a month. And we don't really have any data that tells us that. We don't know. We haven't really researched our body type and all this kind of stuff, and we don't know how many calories are burned. But we have this idea that is not backed up by anything. But then we immediately begin to judge our progress based on this subconscious decision that we've made that it should take so long. In reality, if somebody was a personal trainer or somebody was working with us, and in a month we had lost 3 pounds, and I'm just picking numbers here, but that person may say, you know, you're really ahead of schedule. But if we weren't with them, we wouldn't know that, and we would be thinking, I am really behind schedule here, and I'm just not accomplishing anything. So it's really, I think it's very important to realize, and again, that comes from awareness, that when you pick goals, that, you know, you need to stop assigning these arbitrary numbers as to how long it should take to do this or that, and then begin to judge your progress based on these feelings that you have.
And also you're judging, comparing yourself to other people and basing those comparisons on your sense of self-worth, which of course never works.
That, you know, that's right. I mean, my daughter, who's in college, is taking a nutrition class, and she's very athletic, but she was telling me, and she said, you know, Dad, I wanted to lose about 5 pounds. And she said, well, you won't have any trouble. She said, men lose weight a lot easier than women. It really stinks. But her, you know, her point was that, going to this conversation, is that, like you said, like you could, one person could compare themselves to another person and say, you know, I'm doing all this work, but I'm not losing weight as fast as them. Well, you know, that really is irrelevant because you're really losing weight at the rate that you should lose weight to be healthy in your weight loss, you know, process, so that you're not losing too much weight too fast, so that it will stay off and all that sort of thing. You know, you want to be where you should be. And I think that what ends up happening, and I've watched this, I've learned this through my own personal experience, where I have picked goals and assumed a certain time, and then immediately began to experience being impatient with reaching a goal when I really had no information to tell me how long it should take me to get to the goal. I just made this decision myself and then immediately began to watch myself and make judgments.
Right. Well, this is very helpful for me because I'm just about to start a new job. And it's not like a whole new, it's not like a new area of expertise. It's the same kind of thing I've been doing. But nevertheless, it's a whole learning curve because it's a new place and there are different things about it that I haven't been doing in the job that I've been doing. So I think it's really helpful to apply what you are teaching here to any new thing that we are endeavoring. For instance, the whole idea of just becoming overwhelmed by all the things that need to be done. So you talk about the 4S words, and those 4S words will be very helpful for me in learning, you know, getting involved in this new environment. So could you tell us about that?
The 4S words are simplify, small, short, and slow. And they're really all part of the same context to me. You know, in order to simplify something, you usually break it down into smaller parts. You work on it for a shorter period of time because it becomes easier to stay present, and you work on it at a slower pace. Trying to do anything slow is really impossible unless you stay in the present moment. It takes all of your concentration to do something slow, because for most of us, we never do anything slow, whether it's mm-hmm. walking across the room. And if you look at things like Tai Chi, you find that part of the it's all very, very slow movements, and mm-hmm. the movements themselves are not complicated. And when you watch them, I mean, they're not doing all sorts of strange things with their hands, but they're moving extremely slow. And I have spoken to Tai Chi masters, and they've talked about that it's very difficult, that doing something very slow like that pulls your mind into the present moment. So slowing yourself down is a good way of stopping your mind's momentum and bringing it into the future. And breaking things, as I said, also simplifying things. As a musician, I play several different musical instruments. I learned that, and I also learned from in years of being a concert piano technician and working with the best pianists in the world, that these people, even the most highly skilled people, get to where they're at by breaking these complex pieces into very small parts and working on them for short periods of time, and working on them extremely slow, repeating them over and over again. And I think mm-hmm. this is very important when you're doing anything new, because, you know, I tell people, when you're trying to learn to be more in the present moment, to be more focused, you know, because that's what focus is. Focus is mm-hmm. your mind is on what you're doing and only on what you're doing. And that means that your mind has to be in the present moment. If your mind is in the present moment, your mind is focused. And mm-hmm. And I, you know, you tell people that, you know, in order to do that, you need to learn to this sort of thing here, where you slow down and you work for shorter periods. But when you're trying to do that, and you're trying to begin to make this a part of the natural way that you spend your day, you can't do it in big chunks. In other words, you start out with things like when you're making the bed, be present moment. You know, make the bed slowly, very deliberately. When you're brushing your teeth, you know, be very deliberate. Are you really paying attention? Most of us, when we're brushing the teeth, it's so automatic that our mind is who knows where, but it has nothing to do with brushing our teeth. And mm-hmm. so I tell people, don't try to be, and this really kind of came out from a discussion I had with a family member that called me one day and said, you know, I've been trying to be more present moment, and so I made an effort yesterday to be present moment, and I just couldn't do it. And I said, well, the problem is the word yesterday. You tried to be present moment yesterday. I said, you can't do that. I said, it would take a full-blown master to be able to pull that off. And even a master would only do it in small sections that were chained together like a train. They wouldn't mm-hmm. look at the whole day. They would just look at each moment. I only need to be present for the next 60 seconds. I don't need to be present for 24 hours. Just 60 seconds next to 60
right.
seconds. And after a while, that becomes just the normal way that you process your day. But you need to start out with very small things, and you pick things like I said, eating your bowl of cereal in the morning or ironing your shirt for the day or whatever. But you just pick little things, and you don't – initially I tell people, like, just do the brushing your teeth and let go of it now for the next hour, and then pick something mm-hmm. else. Don't start out by feeling like I have to chain all these things together, because you're setting yourself up. Now you're not working in small sections anymore. You know, so you're not simplifying it. You're just trying to string all this stuff together, and you're making it too much of an effort for the young mind that is trying to be present moment. It's no different than saying, you know, I want to run. If you want to become healthier and a runner, you don't go out and run a marathon without any training. You work
right.
You work up to.
Well, I think another word that you mentioned the person saying is that they tried to live in the present moment. Try is a word that just has an aura of failure about it.
Well, that's true. That's true.
I don't know exactly why, but it does. And so to say that I tried to do something, but then I failed, so I'm not going to do it again, is kind of like an excuse for not doing it again.
Well, and trying, to me, has, when you use the word try, the other, what you're saying is that the other side of it is failure. You know, like mm-hmm. You either succeed or you fail. There is no in between. And so when you say I'm going to try to do this, that means that you've already introduced doubt. Because you have, as you've used the word try, it means you're not sure if you can do it. And then you're going to make this judgment that, well, I either succeeded or I failed. And And I agree. I think that's a bad word to use because there is no failure. There is,
right.
in my mind, you when you work at something, you are building experience and stamina. And so what ends up happening is it depends on how you define the experience. I mean, anything we learn to do, we start at a place of not knowing, and we end up at a place of knowing. We call that mastering it, but we start out as not knowing, and then we get, whether that's learning how to walk, learning how to write the letter B, learning how to do addition, we start out, we don't know, and then we end up knowing. And in between there is what we call learning. And that learning is you try to do the letter B, and you go, oh, I made the top rounded part too big. You know, it's not a failure. It's a learning process. So I think that I would rather someone say, I'm going to learn to do this rather than I'm going to try to do this.
Yeah, because you're giving yourself too much wiggle room. I mean, learning to do it is really a more positive word for it because that is what you're doing.
That is. I mean, you know, like if you stop expecting, having this sense of once again, it's that sense of perfection. It has to be perfect. So, and that, where does that come from? It comes from the sense that when I can do it, everything will be okay. So every instant between now and when I can do it is this thing I have to deal with. And when you look at it as I'm learning to draw the letter B, every moment, every second that your hand is moving the pencil on the paper, you're learning, and because you're learning, you're succeeding. Oh, I went too far that way. Well, you just learned, so you succeeded. You went that you don't go that far that way. You know, instead of going, I failed. I made this portion, you know, go out too far in this direction. It's really, you know, it's so interesting to me that it's these subtle shifts. It's the same process. The process is the same. It's just how you perceive the process and how you interpret the process is what changes your experience of the process.
Yeah, you know, there's some the latest Wayne Dyer book is interesting. I don't know if you've read it, but he talks about I am statements. The more powerful your I am statements are, the more the stronger you are. I am love, I am joy, I am thriving, I am healthy. Those things are not exactly the kinds of I am statements that we generally hear out in public or in general, because people often say I am fat, I am stupid, I am this, I am that. And it's interesting to think about these I am statements are very powerful. They can be very powerful and they can be very weakening. So I have decided to start, I mean, we're going to start starting with simple, simplify my worrying about all of my thoughts that I have to supposedly change to just simplifying it to the I am statement. And working with those has made a dramatic effect in the way that I am thinking these days. You know, the I am that I am is actually a statement of divinity. So it's very important to say I am, you know, the universe, I am the cosmos, whatever, instead of that I am weak, I am ugly, I am stupid, you know what I'm saying.
Well, and I think that what you're reaffirming here is what we talked about you know, earlier, is this awareness. You can't be aware that what your I ams are saying if you're not aware of what your thought is. You know, you have to be able to separate that and say, and be able to listen to yourself. Or you're not listening to you're listening to the thoughts that your mind is creating, and that's when you become aware of, you know, my mind is creating this thought. I am ugly. I am fat. If you can't separate yourself from that, then you aren't in control of it. And you know, an analogy I think that I came up with a while ago, I think it can be helpful to people, is to look at the experience of watching a television commercial. If you look at a television commercial, there are millions of dollars of research that go into crafting a television commercial so that it can manipulate the viewer through their experience of watching it. And what ends up happening is you watch a television commercial, and there are these, as you watch it, you experience these thoughts which elicit emotions and desires and feelings of needs and all these sort of things, which is exactly what is being programmed into you by the commercial. And that's when the commercial is functioning correctly. If you say to the person, look, when this commercial comes on, what I want you to do is I want you to understand that there's been millions of dollars spent to craft this commercial to manipulate a group of people in the society. I want you to tell me who that group is and how they're doing it. And now all of a sudden, it's all the same visuals, it's all the same soundtrack, it's all the same buttons are being pushed, but now this very same person is watching that commercial and it has no impact on them because they're sitting there watching and they're going, well, let me see, there's three guys and one girl, one of the guys is bald, who's asking the questions, who has the wisdom, who doesn't have the wisdom, who is overweight, who isn't overweight, and they start looking at this commercial, and while the commercial is still playing and all that information is still coming off the screen and off the television, but it has no effect on them because they've removed themselves from the commercial. And that's what we're talking about here. When you remove yourself from the thoughts that your mind produces, all of a sudden you begin to become objective and you can look at this. And as you were saying, you can say, you know, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. Well, now you have that privilege and you have that choice because you've separated yourself from all of that.
Right. And the analogy, the example, I should say, that you gave about cleaning a really out of control garage, or cleaning anything that's completely out of control, things piled to the ceiling, you know, that kind of thing. to look at it, so you want to simplify it, you want to take a small section, you want to do it in short increments, like you can say, well, in 20 minutes I'm just going to do this corner and then I'm done, and then you do it slowly so that you can get into the flow of it. That's so cool because it makes things more manageable. So just before the show began, I had about a half hour. So I thought, well, actually 20 minutes. So I thought I would do the dishes in this way. And interestingly enough, they got done instead of, you know, not getting done. They got done, and I was enjoying it because I like to do dishes. And I don't have a dishwasher. You know, that's the other thing. Dishwashers, you're just throwing everything into the dishwasher and you never have the experience of washing a dish. But the experience of washing a dish is a very, very relaxing one if you allow yourself to get into it.
Well, and that's such a great point because there are so many things that we do all day long that can have, they can free us from our anxieties if we just allow ourselves to become immersed in the process. That was one of the things that I found out years ago when I began playing golf seriously and I began to study the swing. And I would take, you know, after working all day, and I would, you know, the kids would be in bed and I would go into my basement with a club that I cut off and stand in front of a mirror. And I would do maybe 200 swings, but I would do 10 swings just looking at my feet and then 10 swings just looking at my knees and then 10. And I would let go when I was looking at my knees. I wasn't looking at my feet. And I would become completely immersed in this repetition of doing this over and over again. And I found that it was like yoga. And I've studied yoga. It was like at the end of it, my mind was so still and all this momentum that had built up in my mind during the day of I got to do this and I have to get that and this is going to have to be done tomorrow. All this sort of stuff, all this speed and agitation was gone because I pulled my mind into just what I was doing right then and there. And it was just an amazing feeling. And what you're talking about, something as simple as washing the dishes can be so calming and bring a sense of inner peace. And it just doesn't seem like that from the outside, but it can. And also, when you look at the counter and you see like all these dirty dishes, like you didn't do them in the morning and then you had to go to work and you come home and then there's the dinner dishes and everything. If you look at that whole thing and you go, what a mess, that creates this feeling of anxiety and the mind starts creating more and more thoughts. But as you just said, if you just say, well, let me just clear this one section here first, the next thing you know, you're on to the next section and then the next section and you're immersed in just the process. And before you know it, you're calm and the dishes are done. And
right.
And it's a wonderful experience. And many times you surprise yourself and you say, you know, that really wasn't as nasty as I expected it to be.
Right. And then I can say, well, after the show is over, I'm going to go and work on the kitchen table.
That's
that
right.
That would really be simple.
Well, actually, you begin to crave these activities that will allow you to do that because you experience what it feels like. You begin to see that, you know, in doing this, I can calm myself and I don't need to buy anything. There's no training in it. It's just being with the moment, and this is what the moment has to offer us.
That's a very satisfying feeling to know that you don't have to buy anything. You don't have to. Well, you do have to do something, but it's more a state of beingness while you're doing it. It's really a perfect combination of being and doing when you get into the state of mind.
Yes, there's no training involved in it. It's something that we all know how to do. At times in our lives, we do it naturally. Anytime we start a new activity that we're really interested in, we become very immersed. Just like, you know, as I said earlier, you watch kids learn a video game. They are so totally engrossed in that. They don't know what else is going on in the room or anything. They're just completely engrossed in the process of trying to master this game.
Right.
You know, that's the advantage of, you know, what we can call beginner's mind, because the beginner's mind is always completely absorbed in the process. Ironically, mm-hmm. what happens for us is the more proficient we get at any skill, the more our mind wants to wander, because it can put it on autopilot. And this is one of the things that has been really studied in sports like golf, because what ends up happening is golf is so different because it's not a reactionary sport. In other words, a ball mm-hmm. isn't thrown at you or a puck isn't hit at you. The ball just basically sits there. It just sits mm-hmm. there and says, you can hit me whenever you want. And so the mind has all this time to worry about making a fool out of yourself or hitting a bad shot or, you know, or mm-hmm. or whatever. And so there's all this mental activity that can occur. And so they've really studied the relationship between the left brain, if you're right-handed, and the right brain, and which brain learns and which brain teaches, and all this mm-hmm. sort of stuff. And it's a fascinating study. But, you know, as I said right at the beginning of this is all being proven out with science. It's not hypothetical at this point. We know
mm-hmm.
how
mm-hmm.
we function best. And even though what I find so fascinating about it, and this is what drew me to it initially, was when I was in college, I became really interested in Eastern thought, and I spent many, many years studying all the different Eastern thought systems. But then in my late 20s, I became very fascinated by sports psychology and the performance psychology and peak performance and all this stuff. And I found it so interesting that what all these empirical Western studies were proving, all the research was showing what had been talked about thousands of years ago. So what that tells me is that the truths are, there's just a couple of truths there about how we operate at our maximum efficiency and
mm-hmm.
how we gain peace and how we learn to feel comfortable in our day and then for our minds to be a nice place to spend our day. And it was talked about back here, but now it's being proven here. So this must work.
Exactly. Now, before we get into your doc, Ackerman, I want you to tell us where we can reach you. What website do you prefer that people go to? I noticed that you are on the Daily Ohm, which is a very cool site. That you submitted articles there. But you must have a website also.
I do have a website, and people can learn what the latest about what I'm doing on thepracticingmind.com. So it's just the same as the title of the book, thepracticingmind.com. And I have quite a bit there. There's links to any place you can buy whatever format of the book you want, whether it's digital or print. And also, I'm coming up with, it will be up soon, there'll be some more video on there, some stuff on a meditation resource page, and some of the other projects that I'm working on that are coming up that will be on the website, some like an online course that people can purchase. And all that sort of thing. And also there is on the upcoming events, there is the places that I'm going to be speaking in a number of places that are around the country, mm-hmm. and people can find that out if they're interested also.
Oh, I like the look of your website. Excellent. And do you blog regularly?
Well, I am starting to, and actually, the site was that I had a website, and we shut that down about almost a year ago, and then built mm-hmm. this site here, which was just came up in, I guess in March was when we finally got that up. The video that's on there, I actually produced. I mean, I wrote all the music for it and did it in the studio, and then did all the video editing and all that sort of stuff. So it was a pretty big project to put that. I wrote all the content, so it was a pretty big project to put that site mm-hmm. together. And I wrote, if you look, there are blogs there. Now I'm just now starting to blog again because it's taken that long for to get the site up, and then because the book, the second version of the book, has been released, I've been kind of everywhere talking and also on the radio a lot. So I've had limited time. Plus, I've written blogs for other people. I've written blogs okay. for golf sites and other things like that. So I've been writing a lot of blogs. I just haven't written them on my own site. But I am also exactly. going to have very shortly, Lynn McDowell, who is a colleague of mine, has been a friend of mine for many, many years, is going to do a guest blog series on my site. And that will start in the next week on stress reduction. And just it's really going to be a very good series, a very fun series for people to read.
Oh, good. I will check back. And do you have a mailing list people can subscribe to our newsletter? Excellent.
They can. And I don't – I'm not a big person on lots of newsletters. I want people to know that. When I send a newsletter out, it's because something is coming up I think that they should know about or they might mm-hmm. be interested in. But I don't send newsletters out every 2 weeks or every week or I'm sorry every month, because I just feel that most people don't have the time to read that. And I do mm-hmm. think that people want to be kept up to speed with bigger events or things like that, or products or whatever that they might be interested in. So that's basically how I do that. So I tell people, if you want to find out when something new is released or there's some big event that might be of interest to you, that's what the newsletter is for.
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
And of course, I do tweet and put it on my Facebook. But the nice thing about the newsletter is it comes right into your email, and you can read it or delete it.
Now your Facebook page is Tom Stirner or The Practicing Mind, or how is
it? It's The Practicing Mind. Everything is set up, the Twitter page. And if you the links are right there on the website. It takes you right
okay,
to the Practicing
excellent,
Mind.
Okay, excellent. So before we leave you, please tell us about DOC, Doc.
Well, one of the things that we need to learn to do is to, when we're trying to do all of this stuff, is to not be attached to the goal and to not judge mm-hmm. our progress. And that was where I came up with the DOC, do, observe, correct. It's just a simple series of letters to remind yourself of your process. And I tell people, if you look at somebody shooting basketball hoops, from the foul line, what do they do? Particularly if it's not winning a game series, they're just shooting foul shots. They look at the hoop. The hoop tells their brain what to do as far as their shot with their arm. They make the shot, and then they observe mm-hmm. what the ball does. And after they observe the ball, they go, that was to the left, it was to the right, it was too far, too short. And then they correct, and then they shoot another mm-hmm. ball. And it's just a series of doing. There is no judgment, because I tell people what you have to understand is that the judging and all of the emotions that come after that have nothing to do with being a better foul shooter. You can get mad and slam the ball down and all that sort of stuff. That's not going to make you make the next shot. All it does is make the experience unpleasant. And it's very important to understand that, because the goal is to get the ball in the hoop. The goal mm-hmm. is not to raise your blood pressure. So it's very important to learn to just detach from the goal and do, observe, and correct. And by doing that, you keep your mind relatively calm, still, and focused, and it's working at its optimum, and you get much better results without all the internal drama.
Right. Oh, I love that.
Well, that comes perfect. From things like, if you look at, I have a pilot's license, and they teach you procedures for what happens if the engine quits, for example, if you have an electrical failure or, say, an engine failure. And when that happens, you're driving along and the engine quits. You know, you've just observed that. Now you need to correct. You have two choices there. You can scream and holler all the way down to the ground, you know, or you can make a decision to look at the situation very objectively and observe it, make the corrections, check the fuel tanks, make sure you've got fuel in both tanks, switch tanks, look to make sure the pump's on, all sorts of stuff. But you can't do that if you're getting mad and having all of this panic and internal drama. And that's, if you look at, you know, Captain Sully, who landed the Airbus on the Hudson River several years ago, there was a perfect example of a guy that in a terrible situation, and, you know, he looked at the situation and he made his corrections and he landed the airplane and everybody walked away from it. That was an extraordinary, extraordinary event. People cannot understand. It's very difficult to explain how extraordinary it was. But if you listen to him talking to the tower, you will find that he is very almost matter of fact. I'm sure internally there was a sense of panic was screaming at him, but he was aware of that and was aware that that is not going to make the situation better. This is what I need to do. And he made observations, and he listened to them. They go, can you do this? He observed, no, I can't do that. Made a correction, can you do this? No, I can't. That is not going to work. He's observing, doing, through his conversation, he's making observations and analysis, and then he made his corrections and landed the airplane on the Hudson, and everybody walked away. So it's a very simple procedure just to remember. When somebody's yelling at you, you know, you're observing their behavior, and you look at what am I experiencing internally. You observe that, and then you make your corrections. If you begin to feel that they're agitating you and you're beginning to fall into this participation with them, it's just a very simple procedure that you go over and over again. You make it a natural part of how you process any situation.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. And then, of course, getting back to the airplane example, you are a pilot, right?
Yes.
So when you go into the plane, you mentally go over the emergency kinds of steps that you have to take in case there's a problem. And then you go about your flight. And then when you land, before you leave the plane, you do the same thing. And you do this so that it becomes, which is why Captain Sully was able to do what he did, because he had these emergency things so clear in his mind at all times. It seems like a miracle. It seems like a miracle that he was able to do that, but in reality, it was just something he did, and that's the way he came across too. It was no big deal.
It was something he had practiced over and over again, and it had become his habitual response to that situation, and that's what we want people to understand. You know, you can make whatever you want your reaction to be to a situation, what you might react to now that you would interpret as being stressful, you can change that, and your habitual response to the same situation can be something totally different. It's all learned experiences, and you do have control over that.
That's right. So I really recommend to our listening audience to get your book, The Practicing Mind, and then you would say : Developing Focus and Discipline in Your Life. You would go to thepracticingmind.com and check out Tom's website. And, you know, thank you so much for being on the show. I've gotten a lot out of it. I appreciate it very much. And I'll become Facebook friends and give you the link to the radio show, too.
Wonderful. That would be wonderful, Kate. I really appreciate that. I really enjoyed talking to you today.
It was really fun. I appreciate it. And you live in Delaware, huh?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do.
Oh, wonderful. Great. Enjoy the rest of your evening.
I will, Kate. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I'm going to be playing music for Mother and Child by Klaus D. Jensen.